Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks in the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, and often and sometimes and eventually at alexlinder.com, but go to VNN Forum. Follow me on gab.com, social media that's open for people who want to speak freely. Used to be Gab AI, still is, but they also acquired Calm. Today we're going to pick up and continue with Serpent's Walk by Randall O. Calverhall, unusual name, from back in 1991, and his story, based in the future, sort of sci-fi Nazi story. We've already done three segments, chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and we'll keep that up through all 29. So today we're going to do 7 and 8, and should take about an hour. Chapter 7, Saturday, July 12th, 2042. You like it? Lessing smiled and handed the manuscript to Lisa. The writing's fair, but doomsday is still a way off. I'm not much interested in politics in your Toten state. Frankly, it doesn't convince me. Ought to. The girl laid the sheaf of paper down, raised herself upon an elbow, and rubbed suntan lotion along one pale golden thigh. Sorry, he reached over and took the plastic bottle from her fingers. You're missing a spot. Let me. It's not politics, Alan, Miss Delacroix said from her lawn chair in the shade. She gestured to take in the enclosed garden, the sun-dappled tiles, the potted plants, the pool, the statuary. It's survival. The survival of Western civilization. Of the way of life you're enjoying now. At the moment, all he wanted was to enjoy it, and Lisa, for it and Lisa, further. He said, thanks for inviting me to stay. She was not to be put off. Yes, of course. But you, people like you, really ought to think about things seriously. After all, the strong survive and the weak perish. That is evolution, the immutable law of nature. And who is still the strongest, even after decades of laziness and ignoring our responsibility to history? We, Alan, the Western ethnos. We are the ones who invent, develop, organize, create, and provide capital and jobs. We have done more than any other group, full of other voices. But we cannot afford to let them divert us. Who would take over? Can you imagine that dreadful emperor of Guinea feeding even his own people, much less the people of Ghana, Nigeria, or anywhere else? If we, our industries, and our expertise were taken away, there would be chaos. Then destruction and an end to all that we, all humans, hold dear. He cast about for another topic. If only she would go take a nap or something. So he's trying to hit on this chick, and he's lecturing about race theory. If only she would go and take a nap or something. Lisa had been friendly last night. He sensed that she was ready to be somewhat more. He found himself thinking of Jamila again. Damn it, harmless fantasy and peace. He couldn't pursue Lisa without coming to terms with Jamila. He had let himself be induced to stop over in Pretoria. He had been nice to Lisa, some might call it courting, but he had gone no farther than a remark or two, a little body contact, and a few drops of suntan lotion courteously applied. So far, he had transgressed only mentally, which was hardly a crime. So far. Did he push it, or did he let it lie? For the moment, he would let it lie. He needed time. The perfume of the suntan lotion mingled with the faint, flowery scent of Lisa's tangled blonde tresses and the sun-warmed salt fragrance of her skin aroused him. He hunted for a safe subject. Who is this Vincent Dom, anyway? I never heard of him. Mrs. Delacroix gave Lisa a look, very arch and very French. You are looking at her. Not I, Lisa there. She is, perhaps, the Dom, while others are the Vincent. What? Then he wondered why he was surprised. There had been talk at the Guatemala City meeting of a committee of writers. All he could have to say was, congratulations. She writes the theoretical parts, Mrs. Delacroix continued. Others do the history and the, how do you say, the action program. You mean the platform? Not exactly. Your word platform is too concrete, a list of very specific proposals. That leads to squabbles and factions within the movement. Instead, we emulate the first Führer. His Weltanschauung was no list of means and goals. It was a view of the future, of a strong Germany, of a society that could lead the West and the world. He had little use for a platform such as the one the party issued in 1920, nor did he fill his book, Mein Kampf, with specifics for people to argue over. His Weltanschauung was his eventual objective, his world vision. Remember, they said last session, Weltanschauung doesn't mean world view, but world vision. Was his eventual objective. His Weltanschauung was his Welt, world, on, schau, look, ing, world onlooking, world vision, world view. Was his eventual objective, but he was pragmatic and expected the details to change according to circumstances. He was a visionary, a prophet, and a guide, an arbiter, a conciliator between individuals and factions. And he was above them all. No Führer now, Lisa shook out her tresses. Have to attract through ideas, not charisma. Behavioral psychologist checking every word of our book. No mention of past, of Nazism, just positive things. Warmth, love, progress, stability. Lessing was amused. You could hire an actor, a Vincent Dorn, to give speeches. Lisa sniffed scornfully and buried her head in her arms to let him massage lotion into the nape of her neck. Mrs. Delacroix took him seriously, however. We thought of that. We may do it yet if we cannot find a charismatic leader. Speeches, television, public appearances, all are so important, n'est-ce pas? Not true. We have also thought of keeping Monsieur Dome anonymous. Comment? Incognito. But that could not continue after we became a public political force, or after we become a public political force. The whole thing struck him as silly. A movement without a leader? A mob of psychologists collaborating with ad men and ghostwriters to compose the Holy Writ? It was a TV executive's wet dream. People were convinced by people, not by books. Physical presence, words and deeds, not abstract theories. Whatever else he may have been, Hitler had the right idea about the realities of personal power. He said it came from oratory, not from the printed word, but from the spoken word, is what Hitler said. Hadn't Alexander, Napoleon, Churchill, Jesus all made it without too much reliance upon tracts and manifestos? Marx and Engels had written books, of course, but then they themselves had not fought in the revolution that swept Tsarist Russia into the dustbin. Men like Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin handled that, for better or worse. Jamila's prophet Muhammad had had a book, of course, the Quran, but he could never have succeeded without charisma. He had given speeches, met people, argued issues, gathered adherents, real live human beings to lead them. That was why abstract, impersonal visions of God tended to become displaced by very human father images, son images, mother images, and pantheons of saints, demigods, imams, gurus, holy mystics, or what have you. Human beings might die for an abstraction, but it would be another human being who convinced them the sacrifice was worth the candle. He uttered a noncommittal grunt. The swimming pool and its surrounding garden were as crystal still as a photograph in some glossy resort brochure, an oasis of serenity cut off from the universe. Nothing entered without Mrs. Delacroix's approval. Nothing was allowed to change. It was as though there would always be sunlight, blue, chlorine-smelling water, tiles that were hot and wet and blindingly white, damp towels, gay-fringed pink parasols, and little rickety tables of glass and wire overflowing with bottles and magazines and all the bric-a-brac of leisure. Lisa rose to her feet and stretched. She picked up a towel, muttered something about a shower, and glided off barefoot, and mostly bare elsewhere as well, toward the house. Lessing's eyes followed her of their own accord. Her legs were very good, indeed. "You will be kind to Lisa?" Mrs. Delacroix's voice sliced into his reverie. "What? You know, I am neither naive nor quite yet senile, eh? It was useless to dissemble. Neither of us. We haven't made any moves yet. You have both made it plain. I leave you two alone, and it becomes bedtime, no?" He laughed at her turn of phrase. "Maybe. Anyway, I have other commitments back in India. Nothing happens until I've decided about those. I don't have fun, then run." "Bien, Lisa?" He said nothing, and she took his silence for assent. "Lisa is American, Alan. like yourself. She ran away from home when she was 12. She does not speak of it, but I think it was her father. Child abuse, you know. The American family is more than half destroyed. The old values gone. She ended in one of your cities, was taken by a black street gang, was put to work as a prostitute on the streets, then was sold to someone in New York who took her to Cairo, a pornographer, a broker in human flesh. One of our people saw her there and bought her, literally. He brought her to Frankfurt and made her, what do you call it, a mannequin, a model of fashions. She was no common prostitute. Anyone could see that. She had too much, I do not know the expression. Class, Lessing murmured. Ah, oui, class. I was raised in the Free Republic of the Congo, now neither free nor a republic, but that is another story. My English is better than my German, my grandfather's language, but my French is best. Do you speak French, Alan? He shook his head, and she gave him a mournful little half-smile. Too sad, you Americans. No languages. So, Lisa suffered. Indeed, I need not tell of it. You'll hear the effects in her speech. She does not find it easy to converse. She writes, though. Her writing is good and gets better. So that was why Lisa spoke as she did. My God, he breathed. How she must hate. Ah, no, not hatred. Not the way some women hate men, with less cause. Not Lisa. She is hard and cautious, like a crab in a shell. Tough and ready to fight, but fragile and inside very soft. She tries to be philosophical. What happened to her happens to many these days. She does not hate, but she does want to dismantle the system that hurt her. Replace it with a world in which such horrors cannot exist. Who could blame her? But she's an idealist. There'll always be wars and killing and cruelty and exploitation and crime and prostitution. No government, no movement, no starry-eyed political philosophy will stop those. There speaks the mercenary, the soldier, the pragmatist. Perhaps you are right, Helen. But we, Lisa and the rest of us, have to try. Otherwise there is no point to life, eh? He wiped his face and shoulders roughly with a fluffy blue towel Lisa had given him. Suddenly the chlorine smell of the swimming pool was suffocating. I have to get back to India. I don't want to put you out. Put me out? What does it mean? Oh, to disturb me? No, my secretary, Mrs. Van Tassel, has your tickets and documents. I shall add a gift to repay you for your services. She rose to her feet, twitched her white sundress into place, and smiled. So, you and Lisa? Not now? He grinned back. Later, maybe. She laughed outright. Lisa needs a good man, Alan. Perhaps you are good enough? A challenge? He chuckled and followed her into the house. Dinner was awkward. Neither an average middle-class American upbringing nor years in various armies had prepared Lessing for people who ate with 12 pieces of silverware. Thank God South Africa had at least a guest were attired in a miscellany of sportswear, bush shirts, and business suits. The four women, including Lisa, wore fashionable Chongsum-like dresses slit up the thigh, made of a metallic-looking, silky, synthetic fabric, and accompanied by matching bodices with a little over the jacket of translucent, lacy stuff. Sex had joyfully returned after long decades of stuffy, born-again Puritanism. The only one wearing a traditional dinner gown was their hostess herself, as regal and gracious as a portrait of some dowager empress. Lessing found himself between an elderly Afrikaner and a younger man in the uniform of a captain of the South African police. The former sized Lessing up at once, made a polite remark or two, and then turned to the woman on his right to discuss horse racing in Johannesburg. The policeman was more forthcoming. Bluff, balding, tanned, and familiar with the profession of arms. Mutual mercenary friends offered a starting point, and they went on to talk of native resistance groups, racial unrest in America, about which the policeman knew more than Lessing, who hadn't lived there for years, and the present situation in his own country. "We're coming to it," the captain said, unhappily. "Sooner or later we shall have another great massacre like the one back in 2000. Then many more, both white and black, will be killed, and again nothing will be solved." "What can do?" Lisa asked from across the table, "to stop it." Lessing was getting used to her disjointed way of speaking. The captain rubbed at his wispy mustache. "Like last time, military force. Socially, we've gone as far as we can. Education, healthcare, jobs, housing. the, pardon my language, bloody lot, the blacks want to do, the bloody lot, the blacks want to do to us what they did to Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. First independence, then a very proper British black government, then a president who's little more than a dictator, then army rule, then tribalism, then persecution of the white minority, and finally expulsion of whatever whites are left, then a shambles like Zimbabwe today. Spots of color appeared in his cheeks. Damn it, I'm as African as these people, ancestors here since the 1600s and all that. I won't give up my home any more than an English American who is politely asked to leave by Red Indians. Same case, different ratio of natives to whites, that's all. Lessing had heard the arguments before. By his own lights, the captain was only describing the situation realistically. Philosophically, morally, worlds, perhaps there ought not to be any racial conflict. Yet the human animal, black or white, was aggressive and acquisitive, and whichever side was on top would almost certainly abuse its position. History proved that, and there were no signs of humanity undergoing a change of heart. Like the old saw said, "They ain't no justice." One had only to look at the Jews in Palestine, the British in Ireland, and any of a dozen other instances. He was glad when the captain let the subject drop. As he watched Lisa and the others, he felt an emotion to which he could put no name. A vague disquiet, a doomed fatedness, like a man from the future seated at the last dinner on the Titanic. The bright, brittle conversation passed over and around him and echoed off into nothingness, the words no more than shards of glass clashing and ringing and tinkling like the wind chimes on his parents' back porch in Iowa. Or just plain porch. In this company, he was as far out of his element as the broiled lobster Lisa was daintily devouring. These elegant, overly mannered people were a soap opera on the holo video. Whatever they said and did had no relevance to the real world. Covert observation of the old duffer on his right showed him proper knife and fork for the roast beef and the correct wine to go with it. He made no unpardonable gaffes, at least no one leaped up to denounce him as an untutored low-class slob. Actually, it was funny. He had little affinity for these people, but as the meal drew to a close, he realized that he could cope if he really wanted to do so. Etiquette and chit-chat were like camouflage paint. You put it on when you went out on patrol. It wasn't part of you. Eddie knew how silly you looked with your face all daubed green and yellow and black, but you wore it because it meant survival. It was the same here. Dessert came and went, then coffee. They got up. The ritual now required after-dinner drinks and conversation. "My name's Hoykins, Peter Hoykins." The police captain put out a bronzed hand for Lessing to shake. "Didn't catch yours." "Alan Lessing." The man blinked and the muscles in his jaw tensed. "Lessing? Oh, I say. "Something wrong?" He sensed Mrs. Delacroix's gaze upon him from the far end of the table. No, not really. "What's the problem?" Lessing asked. "Could we speak privately?" The man signaled urgently to Mrs. Delacroix. The sitting room the old woman took them was rarely used, an oasis of dark leather furniture, tribal shields and spears, subdued lighting from massive bronze lamps as big as barrels. Animal skins, African kitsch, Lessing thought. Kitsch is junky art. Mrs. Delacroix turned upon Hoykins and raised an imperious eyebrow. "What is it, Peter?" The captain sighed. "Two things. Three, really. First, you are that Alan Lessing who works for Indico in India, I think." "Yes." "So?" "Been a comeuppance at your plant there. Accident. Burned down part of it." "My God, how? Who? What? Anybody hurt?" He thought of Jamila. "Don't think so, but can't say. Came in over the telecom link earlier as I was leaving for this bash." "The other two things?" Mrs. Delacroix urged. "Both the same. Different sources. 3 days ago, Europol put out an AD order, that's apprehend and detain, for one Alan Lessing. The Americans want him on suspicion of murder, theft, and for God's sake, treason. What the devil did you do, man?" "The third thing?" He kept his voice calm. He saw no reason to enlighten Hoykins. Hoykens. "The Israelis came through with the same demand the day after Europol got on the line. Catch this Lessing and hold him for an interrogation team from Jerusalem." "You would do that for them? The Zionist? Snapped Mrs. Delacroix. Have to. Hoykins fiddled apologetically with his cufflinks. We supply Israel with arms and aid, and they us, you know. They swat flies in the north of Africa, and we swat flies down south. Not that we love the Izzy's, but, well, one hand washes the other, and that sort of thing. The old woman put her hands on her hips and glared up into Hoykins' reddening face. This Alan Lessing, he is Herman Mulder's, how do you say, protege. He is one of us. You know, damn it, madame, nothing personal. Fine, listen to me. You came tonight, you met Alan, but you never heard his name. He goes by my private jet to somewhere at once. Back to India, Lessing put in firmly. India. They, the Americans at least, have extradition treaties with India. You will be arrested. I have to chance it. I have reasons. Hoykins interrupted him. The Americans, State Department, CIA, I don't know which, knew you were here and how you got here. Not why. The Israelis just seem to be pushing all the likely buttons. The two of them haven't got together yet. You were sent here specifically to find Mr. Lessing? Mrs. Delacroix fixed the officer with a needle-sharp eye. A spy? My heavens, madam, of course not. My superiors know you and I are friends, but not that Mr. Lessing would be here tonight. Anyhow, we have powerful support up top, and neither the Americans nor the Zionists are exactly welcome, what with their views of our internal policies and all. Meaning apartheid. No, this was just coincidence. Lessing had heard enough. Anything else? Otherwise, I'll take that offer of a plane for India. Neither the U.S. nor Israelis are popular there. It'll be months before an extradition order gets through Delhi's red tape. Of course, Mrs. Delacroix said, and by then your Mr. Mulder will have thought of something. I have just one small traveling case. I'll get it and be ready in 10 minutes. Now I'd like to say goodbye to Lisa, please. Oh, the captain flung after him as he turned to go. I say, Mr. Lessing, one more bit of information. Seems both the Americans and the Zionists are hunting not only for you, but for an accomplice of yours as well. Best tell him to go to ground, too. Who? Lessing thought of Bauer, then of Hollister, and lastly of Rose Thurley. Some chap named Pakov. I think that was the name. Russian, eh? Lessing fled up the stairs toward the bedroom Mrs. Delacroix had provided him. The ignorant see my grandfather's Germany as a place of ultimate horror. This is a long quote from a letter, a fictional letter, that will end, I believe, this chapter 7. The ignorant, Mrs. Delacroix is from, the ignorant see my grandfather's Germany as a place of ultimate horror, a scene in which the major landmarks are the labor camps, the secret police, and the darkness of despair. They fail to note that the only ones in despair were those who were not part of our society, those who were alien by birth, or those who had alienated themselves by their selfishness, their decadence, or their adherence to alien causes or creeds. They omit, often deliberately, the happy scenes, a recovering economy, jobs, stable currency, new highways, and construction everywhere, an end to the street fighting between left and right, art and music, and a healthy interest in nutrition, exercise, and sports. Most Germans were optimistic for the first time since before World War I. It ended all too soon for most of us. We had a few years of peace, and then came the long and terrible night of war. We Germans knew that our country did not start the war, although we weren't permitted to say so after 1945. We were the bulwark of Western civilization against the Asiatic hordes and the madness of communism. The war brought casualties, bombings, rationing, forced labor, and all the horrors of a society being pounded into rubble. We endured it bravely. And even gladly. We were fighting for positive values, for the survival and progress of our people. You ask about labor camps and oppression? Tell me, what would you Americans have done, surrounded by enemies? How would your gentle liberals have treated their camps full of Nisei if Japanese armies were advancing through California? Let them look into their own souls and then say honestly whether they would have done differently than we did. Paint the future in gay colors and show the world that a totalitarian state is no regimented monster. No wars, no violence, no tyranny, no tanks rumbling in the night. not a military takeover, but a free election, such as the plebiscite that swept our first Führer to power in 1933. People must vote us into office. Why? Because we are the best chance this planet has. Perhaps the only chance. The last chance before Armageddon. The world must realize this. From a personal letter from Mrs. Emma Delacroix to Miss Anneliese Meisinger, dated January 31st, 2042. And that either ends 7 or starts 8. Chapter 8, Monday, July 14th, 2042. What was the guy's name? Wrench twisted at the wheel of the little Ikeda, I-K-E-D-A, outdoorsman to avoid a gaggle of children and water buffalo in the rain-soaked road ahead. The one that came home after 20 years and only his old dog recognized him. Odysseus, Lessing replied. How in hell do you know about him? They stopped teaching Greek and Lit in high school 50 years ago, even in English translation. Wrench feigned insult. Hey, man, I got culture. I read it in a World Classics comic book. Anyway, it doesn't apply to me. I've been gone less than a week. I still feel like a dog, Mulder says. Go get Lessing. I go get Lessing, all the way to Lucknow. Wrench squinted and racked the vehicle down to make a turn. Woof, woof. Out here, I feel like a dog most of the gubbin time. The monsoons had lowered over the dry North Indian plain since dawn. Now they became a cataract that thundered down with the revengefulness of an angry god. Mrs. Delacroix's jet had dropped Lessing off at Palam Airport in Delhi, P-A-L-A-M, and the local flight to Lucknow was late, as usual. Lessing felt like a discarded mango peel, limp, tepidly wet, sticky, smelly, and gritty all over. He hung on grimly against all that Wrench could do. Wrench had told him about Indico, not another break-in, as Lessing had feared, but a mass demonstration outside. There had been perhaps 100, quote, students, and another dozen unidentifiable gundas, ruffians, quote-unquote, the Hindi term for anything from the prodigal son to Al Capone, who were undoubtedly paid agitators, though nobody knew whose. The plant chowkidars had taken one look and fled, leaving the mob free run of the plant. Indico would now have to rebuild 3 warehouses and replace some machinery. But no one had been seriously injured. Mulder was furious. He was talking of adding a score of foreign mercs to the Mir's. You know what? That must be a misprint. I'm reading off a POF, so a lot of the words are jammed together. So if I make mistakes, it's not purely my own incompetence. It's something that's actually difficult. And maybe these Mir's is... Except I don't know why they would always get the turn. Maybe it's supposed to be mercs, but I think they were actually maybe calling them Mirs. Either way, Mirs or mercs. He was talking of Mirs. Doesn't seem to make sense, but at the start there was some mention of it, so it may be a thing in this book. He was talking of adding a score of foreign mercs to his security force, and the PDF is scanned and a lot of the letters are just flat wrong, so I'm reading through that. So it's kind of like running in a broken field, just so you understand. He was talking of adding a score of foreign mercs or mirrors to his security force, but getting clearance for them from Delhi would not be quick or easy. Most important of all to Alan Lessing was the fact that Jamila was safe and waiting for him. He felt greater relief than he wanted to admit, even to himself. There was something new on the runoff leading from the main highway to the plant. A straw-thatched hut and a cloth-draped pole down across the road. They put in a police post, Wrench grumbled, for our protection from more incidents. He produced papers, shoved them at the dark, dripping face that poked itself into the driver's window, held out a 10-rupee note, watched it disappear into the night, and drove on. Jamila, Mulder, Goddard, and 3 Indians awaited them on the veranda of the main house. Servants with clumsy black umbrellas splashed out to the decida, and Lessing proceeded to flout 1,000 years of Indian tradition by marching over and embracing Jamila in public. Her warm, dry, spice-fragrant body felt wonderful. "You smell besamed," she whispered in his ear, the Urdu word meant stinking, like raw meat. Mulder cleared his throat. Meet Colonel Srivastava, Indian Army, assigned to protect Indico until there's been an investigation. This is Sub-Inspector Mukherjee, Uttar Pradesh Police, and Mr. Subramanian from the CID. Gentlemen, Mr. Alan Lessing, Chief of Plant Security. He's been away on a business trip. Lessing was tired. He could barely see the figures around him or feel the hands they reached out to shake his. He heard Mrs. Mulder's tremulous fairy godmother soprano chirping at Jamila. Take him upstairs to the guest bedroom. It's too late to go back to your own apartment. Then, somehow, he was in there, a boxy, whitewashed little room with frilly curtains. Jamila shooed servants out and herself struggled with a cantankerous plumbing to produce hot water for a shower. Then he was in bed. He awoke thinking how he hated to sleep on a hillside, his head higher than his feet. Where in hell was he? Syria? Yes, north of Damascus, and with his mere comrades in the gully below him and Major Berger's crack Israeli brigade over the ridge where they were taking fire from those new big mortars the Russians had given the Iranians. The shit was heavy over there, and any minute Berger's airstrike would come in at... Why was he so cold and damp, so damp, in Syria? He rubbed his eyes with his knuckles and was surprised when the scene dissolved and coalesced again into an unfamiliar bedroom. It contained one cushioned chair, a huge clothes cabinet that Jamila called Anomari, and the British, who could never pronounce anything foreign, and Almira, a slow-turning ceiling fan, and electric wireless stapled to the wall. A liney, harmless lizard, which Jamila called an Achipkili, walked upside down over the ceiling over his head. The roar of Iranian mortar burst became the gurgle of ancient air conditioner Mulder was always intending to replace. It did keep the room both clammy and damn near freezing. He glanced down and saw why he had dreamed of sleeping on a hillside. Goddard was sitting on the foot of the bed, his ponderous weight enough to scuttle an ocean liner. Goddard was not only big, he was bristly as a boar. His broad skull, the backs of his hands, his shoulders, all were covered with springy, coarse, black hair. The light from the window made a halo around his head, something he would have only if Satan ruled in heaven. How old was he, anyway? 40? Goddard was an American from Chicago, a hard-ass, a comer, a would-be exec, smart, and on his way up to the top of Indico's dung heap. Lessing used the opportunity to kick out with both feet as though just waking up. Goddard let out a satisfying yelp and leaped off the bed. Christ! You kick your little Indian chickie like that and you'll break all her bones. Lessing yawned in his face. Goddard wasn't worth hating. Mulder's coming. He wants to see you. I'm here. He got up, found his gear had been stored in the Almira, and dug out his shaving things. Make out with that blonde? He let the plumbing answer for him. The faucet belched, hiccuped, and gushed a stream of brown fluid that slowly changed into steaming hot water. He shut the door in Goddard's beefy face so he could use the facilities. When he emerged, Herman Mulder was sitting in the one chair. Wrench occupied the foot of the bed, and Goddard now leaned against the wall by the window. Mulder waited in Buddha-esque silence until Lessing had settled down again at the head of the bed. When he spoke, it was just one word. Pakov. Sir, please don't lie. Lessing had no intention of lying. He had been about to suggest that a mercenary's jobs were as privileged as a priest's confessional or a psychiatrist's couch. More, Amir could get thumb for a breach of security. Opfos and employers alike frowned upon loose lips. He shut his mouth with an audible snap. Mulder appeared not to notice. You're alive because of us, Alan. Very few know who or what we represent, but everybody knows that we protect our people, particularly in the Third World. Sir, hear me out. Only a very determined foe would attack you while you're with us. Yet somebody is willing to risk their lives to get at you. The foe may believe that we sent you out to get, and that we behave, Pakov. And that we have Pakov, which endangers us. Do you see? The raid to get the books doesn't seem to have been connected with you at all, Goddard added. Maybe some other super core sniffing around to see what they could find and almost hitting the jackpot. It's possible they were Israelis or the vigilantes for Zion. The Izzy's and the Vizzy's have come close before. Never this close, Wrench protested. How did they know the diaries were here? All under control now. Mulder wiped his naked pink forehead with an old-fashioned handkerchief. The last raid, the local scholars and their friends, was not directed at us. They were looking for you again, Alan. It was lucky that Miss Husseini was over at the main office. Two of their non-Indian agitators got into your headquarters and made a thorough search. Hitting Indico was a diversion. Nothing seriously damaged, just yelling and burning and prancing around, and a lot of pretending to find dangerous pollutants and killer chemicals. They didn't even try to wreck the computer that controls our agrochemical mixes. Lessing said, Mr. Mulder, I can't, won't, tell you more than you know. The name you mentioned is my business, privileged information. It has nothing to do with you or Indico, I'll swear to that. Wrench struck a heroic pose. The code of the West. The masked merc rides again. Lessing had an insanely funny urge to match Nunn and cry, Bring on your Gestapo, I'll never talk. Mulder, however, had little sense of humor, and Goddard even less. Shall I tell you then, Alan? Mulder held up a thick hand, as pale and hairless as a baby's. You went on a mission for one Senhor Gomez, a Goanese mere broker. You traveled to the United States to an installation with the code name Marvelous Gap, located in New Mexico. It was built just after the turn of the century, during the worst period of born-again paranoia. Then it was officially lost. Closed down. No mention. No records. The place would be an embarrassment to President Rubin's peace initiative if the Russians found out it still existed. There'd be hell to pay in Geneva, and the United Nations would make a TV sitcom out of it. The present U.S. government thinks it's better to let Marvelous Gap stay marvelously. Lessing saw no reason to tell Mulder of Huyken's information and the reason for his precipitous flight from South Africa. Mulder and his SS might decide he was more trouble than he was worth. He said, I'm a soldier. Politics isn't my job. I follow orders. Mulder sighed. They didn't accept that excuse at Nuremberg. He saw that Lessing hadn't understood. That was before your time. Never mind. While you were in Pretoria, I sent a coded cable to Washington. Our people there have been investigating Pakov and another born-again projects for some time. They punched some buttons, and now I know all there is to know outside of some top-secret data in the National Security Agency. The movement has friends in Washington, friends with access to the government's biggest databanks. The Pakov formulae were all destroyed, as were the administrative records, right down to the mess hall grocery lists. But they missed one document here and another there. That's the virtue of computers. Once you find a clue, you get the computer itself to hunt for more. It collates everything, patches it together, and hands it to you in a printout. Lessing shook his head. Still nothing to do with me. I'm only the errand boy. I don't care what's in the package. Yes, well, PACOV stands for Pandemic Communicable Virus, one of the uglier results of military experimentation with recombinant DNA. Do you know what that is? I've read magazines. Do you want to read what technical details we have? The cable's on my desk. I'm no scientist. Actually, he would probably understand most of it. Lessing kept up on military developments as part of his trade. Very well, let me tell you in layman's terms. Mulder extended a hand to Shush Wrench, who had started to speak. Pakov consists of two separate reworkings of the DNA chains of existing viruses. It's a piggyback weapon, a two-stage operation. You send in the first stage. The vectors, agents of transmission, for Pakov 1 are extensive. It travels through the air, the water, or directly from person to person, and is highly contagious. It spreads for hundreds of miles if conditions are optimal. Pakov 1 causes only a mild flu-like infection that disappears within a day or two. Public health authorities would overlook it, never consider it a serious epidemic. Even if they did, they'd have to look carefully to isolate it. Once a victim is over the flu, Pakov 1 becomes dormant and almost undetectable. A month or two later, you send in the second stage. Pakov 2 is also a virus, just as contagious as the first, and just as harmless by itself. But it reacts with Pakov 1, however, to produce a powerful coagulant. A coagulant, Alan, a substance that turns your blood into jelly. Your heart isn't made to pump strawberry jam, and you die within 3 minutes. No warning, no vaccine, no cure. Those not exposed to both stages remain unharmed. There might be a few immunes, but they didn't do a lot of testing, as you can imagine. Pakov 2 goes inert like Pakov 1 within a week or two. Then you get your victim's country, all his property, in undamaged condition, and a lot of corpses to bury. Mulder paused. Does this convince you, Alan? It did. Pakov terrified the born-agains. They had opened the gate and come eyeball to eyeball with the worst nightmares of hell. They ripped out the installation at Marvelous Gap and scattered its personnel around to other projects. Maybe they even killed those most closely involved. They were no more noble than any government before or since. It wouldn't surprise me. What would happen if somebody used Pakov today? Mulder inspected the half-moons of his tiny salmon-pink fingernails. No idea. No data. Perhaps the stuff is too old and has gone inert. Perhaps it never would have worked. All we know is that it was intended as a last resort. The checkmate move, the doomsday weapon. No, worse. More like the last tantrum of a very bad loser. Leap up, shoot your opponent, and kick the chessboard to smithereens. Pakov was meant to destroy nations, Alan. Millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of people. Jesus, Goddard muttered. Mulder made a downward circling motion. The last trump. Not with a bang, but with a gurgle. Down the toilet. All mammalian life within the target area. God, Wrench explained, what good's an army with that stuff? Mulder raised his head to look at the little man. Quite right, Charles. In the old days, an army consisted of human beings with swords and spears, guns and cannon, whatever was the state of the art at the moment. You could see the enemy, watch him coming, gird up your loins and fight. Then warfare went out into space. Missiles, bombs, satellites, platforms. You, the intelligence agencies, can still see those weapons, but they're so powerful that neither side dares to start a war. The only atomic devices used in this century were dropped during the China-Vietnam War. And we've learned a lesson from that, Lessing said. Quite so, hopefully at least. But you see where I'm going. A conventional army costs money, but every state can afford something, and it's visible to its foes. Space weapons are prohibitively expensive. Billions tolerate, decade after decade, generation after generation. They're too powerful to employ without a risk of a retaliation that will turn your own country into a radioactive wasteland, and they're still relatively easy to keep track of. Both you and your opponent know what's there. He tapped the chair arm for emphasis. Think, though. All you need for Pakov, or for the toxic counterpart the Russians call Starak, S-T-A-R-A-K, is a handful of scientists, a wet lab, and a delivery system. Cheap, cost-effective, easily concealed. Any petty terrorist organization can afford it. Any banana republic, any fanatic religious sect. He got up and came over to stand over Lessing. Just how big were those Pakov canisters? It didn't matter now. He might as well tell it. A little globe, like a Christmas tree ornament, and a cylinder about this size, he indicated 4 inches between thumb and finger. His own stash of Pakov came to mind. Maybe Mulder's movement, the descendants of the Nazi SS, were indeed reform, just another bunch of nice guys making a living through hard work and honest capitalism. He didn't trust them. Not them, not anyone. He was willing to tell Mulder that some of what he knew, but he'd be damned if he'd hand his samples over to these people or to anybody. Except maybe God himself, and only then if the big guy asked politely. Mulder wiped pearls of sweat from his forehead. A family enters a country as tourists. Pakov 1 goes along in a box with their children's toys. Wrench uttered a nervous giggle, with a clown face painted on it. Mulder scowled in irritation. Yes. A month or two later, a man arrives with Petkov 2 disguised as a deodorant stick or a tube of insect repellent. He goes to his hotel room, cracks the container in the sink, and leaves again. He's safe because he wasn't exposed to Petkov 1, which is now quiescent. And everybody in the target area dies, Goddard breathed. True, Mulder said, but messy. There are no neat limits to a biological weapon, no idea how long it will really last. Viruses are unpredictable, and they can mutate. Did you know there's still an island near Scotland that is uninhabitable because of British experiments after World War II? Almost a century later. Biological weapons are cheap and effective, but they're a two-edged sword. As blackmail, Goddard held up his cupped hand and made a throttling gesture. What if your target calls your bluff? Don't be stupid, Bill. They might decide to sterilize your side of the planet with atomic bombs, or use Starak or another BW agent of their own. And if Petkov got out of hand, you could end with a cemetery instead of a world. No one spoke for a time. The sun had grown insistent, and waves of heat beat against the rippled, bubbly glass of the window pane. The old air conditioner chugged and sputtered, just managing to keep the inferno outside at bay. Mulder wiped his face. Wrench fidgeted, and Goddard sat like a carved behemoth. Lessing pulled the pillow around, both for comfort and also to watch the other three. Silent watching often got better results than speech. "They blame us, my ancestors, for genocide," Mulder mused. "Is Petkov our doing? Those missiles in the sky? Yes, we fought a war, and yes, we bombed and shot and slew. So did the Allies. Match Auschwitz against the firebombing of Dresden or the horror of Hiroshima. All horrible, all stupid. We've learned, Alan, learned a lot in 100 years. Lessing blurted out, "And the Holocaust? Didn't Wrench tell you that there never really was one, at least not in the way the Jews tell it? Forced labor and camps and disease and maltreatment? Yes, it was wartime, and my ancestors did what they believed they had to do. And there were some shootings in the Eastern Territories, mass executions of Jews and communist guerrillas, but no gas chambers or any of the other fanciful inventions claimed by the Jews. But it's always the victors who write the histories." "And hold the war crimes trials," Wrench whispered. "Anyhow, whether there was a Holocaust or not is irrelevant in this age. No one wants a war that will end life on Earth. Nor can one people rule a world of slaves. The Israelis have expanded into a slave empire, and they are just beginning to reap the whirlwind. No, we'll win our way, Alan. We are the people who invented the technology and organization that makes this modern world possible. We are fitted to win. We want a healthy people, a healthy environment, a healthy world. A radioactive desert or a rotten orange crawling with germs neither is of use to us or to the Jews or anyone else." Lessing said slowly, "I don't know whether I believe you or not. I don't know that I care whether I believe you. It all happened 100 years ago. Your Hitler is as dead as last week's curry." Goddard stiffened, but the others ignored him. "What do you intend to do, Mr. Mulder? What do you want me to do?" Mulder heaved himself to his feet, Goddard leaning forward solicitously to lend a hand. "We want you to find Petkov." "Who paid you? Who's got it now?" "Ask Gomez." Goddard snorted. "Gomez is dead, Lessing. His heart stopped with a bullet in it." Lessing stared. "Who? When?" "You thumbed him. That's the rumor. We know you didn't because you were in Pretoria. But the Mirs don't know that. In some circles, you're dead meat." "But you know other Mirs," Wrench prompted. "People above Gomez's level." "You can go and inquire," Mulder interrupted smoothly, "or you can go your way and face those waiting for you outside Indico's fences. The Izzy's are looking for you, and the Americans want you. Somebody knows about Petkov and the Marvelous Gap. Somebody who either wants to interrogate you or see you unzipped. We can protect you. You can stay here for a while, and if things blow over, fine. Otherwise, we can hire you as chief of security at Club Lingani, our new spa on the island of Ponape. The South Pacific is lonely, but it's safe." "He'd have to leave his Indian popsy here," Goddard sneered. Surprisingly, Mulder turned on the man. "That's enough, Bill. Do you know where the word Aryan comes from?" Sanskrit. Bill, the ancestor of Hindi and other North Indian languages, it originally meant noble. India was invaded about 1500 BC by the Aryans, relatives of our own ancestors. The wings of Goddard's fleshy nose flared. Mr. Mulder, are you saying that these Pakis are white? Wrench tittered, but Mulder did not flinch. Many in the upper castes are. At least so Alfred Rosenberg, one of the leading theoreticians of the Third Reich, said, though he did add that they had become mixed. In any case, the first Fuhrer treated them as Aryans. There was a Waffen-SS division, the Freie Hind, made up of anti-British Indians. It spent the war near the Bay of Biscay, I think. It saw no combat, but it was racially acceptable to Reichsfuhrer Himmler. Spots of angry red burned in Goddard's cheeks. I suppose blacks are Aryans, too. Not black Africans, certainly, but there were Muslims in the Waffen-SS. Wrench appeared to be enjoying the turn the conversation had taken, and he cut in. The Hanshar division, right, Mr. Mulder? Didn't the first Fuhrer once line them up and hand out little Qurans to wear around their necks? Qurans with swastikas on them? I think so. Mulder wiped his forehead again. There were many men of many nationalities, Ukrainians, Latvians, Estonians, Dutch, Flemish, French, Romanians, Hungarians, even some Britons in the SS. More than just blonde Germanic supermen, many different white subgroups. Not everybody was as pure-minded as Obergruppenführer Theodor Eicke, who complained that even many Volksdeutschen, Germans who lived outside Germany, were too weak and undisciplined to serve as replacements in his Totenkopf division. And what if the Reich had won? All those different peoples, all those languages and cultures and traditions. I know what your faction wants, Bill, but it won't work. Even if you cleanse the earth of every black and Jew and every non-German, including yourself, being of French and English descent, I recall, you'd still have to build a world. Hatred is a useful motive in combat, but it makes for very poor economic or administrative policies. You have to look beyond your immediate horizons, Bill. He made soothing motions with his handkerchief. Clearly, he did not want a quarrel. Goddard struggled with himself, managed a smirk, and grated, "Excuse me, sir." He went out. "A good man," Mulder looked after him ruefully. "Enlightened racism, the service of our Western ethnos, is the theoretical basis of our movement. But Bill takes it too far, and then doesn't take it far enough beyond that." Lessing had decided, "I want to go to see a man in Paris," he said. "I'll try to find out about Pakov, who got it, who wants me. I don't promise to give it to you, nor do we want it. It should be destroyed safely, but I have to know for my own good." "Fair enough. Miss Hillary down at the plant will get you tickets and reservations. Leave any time. After I've seen Jamila." And that's the end of Chapter 8 of Randolph Calverhall's Serpent's Walk. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record so far, these first 8 chapters of Serpent's Walk, a novel from 1991, at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon with more from Serpent's Walk.